This morning, we'd like to take up a koan from the Mumon Khan. It's Tohusan Carries His Bowls. And the case reads, one day Tohusan went down toward the dining room holding his bowls. Seppo, the head cook, asked, where are you going with your bowls? The bell has not rung, nor has the drum been struck. Tohusan turned and went back to his room. Seppo told Ganto about all of this, and Ganto said, Tohusan is well known as a great teacher, but even so he doesn't know the last word of Zen. Tohusan heard of this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. You do not approve of my teaching? He asked. Ganto whispered to Tohusan. Tohusan was silent, and the next day he ascended to the rostrum, and behold, his teisho was quite different from usual. Ganto, going to the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, congratulations, our old man has got the last word. From now on, nobody will be able to take the rise out of him. And then the commentary, as for the last word, it has never entered the mind of either Ganto or Tohusan. When you come to look into the matter, you find they are both like puppets on the shelf. And the verse, to know the first word is to know the last, but neither the first nor the last is a word. This koan is about the Diamond Sutra, or it's a comment on the Diamond Sutra. You possibly know the story of Tohusan. He was at one time a teacher of the Diamond Sutra. He was a lecturer, something like you might get university lecturers, university professors lecturing on comparative religion. And he heard on one occasion that in the south of China there was a group called the Zen Buddhists who were claiming that it was possible to come to full Buddhahood in one lifetime. This rather incensed Tohusan because his teaching and what he was teaching was that it took lifetimes and that it was just a very gradual process, whereas the Zen Buddhists were saying that it was a very sudden process. So he decided that he would go south and set the Zen Buddhists to right. That just gives you just a small example of his humility. On his way, when he got down into the south, he happened to call in on what's like a small cafe, a small restaurant. And he decided that he would take a rest there. And he sat and ordered sort of cookies and tea. And the cookies actually in China at the time were called mind refreshers. And you could imagine that he would be somewhat imperious. Here he was, he's got this great bundle of notes on the Diamond Sutra that he'd carried all the way from the north of China. You know, they used to carry these things on a pole, sort of balanced on their shoulder. And he'd brought all of these notes, and this was what he was going to slay the dragon of Zen Buddhists with. And you could imagine that he sat down with some degree of pomposity. And there was this old lady, and he was probably quite somewhat haughty in relation to her. And so he said he wanted these cookies, these mind refreshers. And the old lady looked at him, and then she saw this bundle of notes. She said, what has the master got there? Oh, he said, I got notes. These are my studies on the Diamond Sutra, and I'm going to teach these Zen Buddhists a few things about the Diamond Sutra, which obviously they don't know. Oh, she said, the Diamond Sutra. Yes, the Diamond Sutra. Well, in the Diamond Sutra, it says past mind is unattainable, future mind is unattainable, present mind is unattainable. Tell me, good sir, which mind are you going to refresh with the mind-refreshing cookies? And he was quite stunned. He had no way that he could answer this woman. Here he was, all ready for battle, and he trips over this old woman. He was so shaken that he asked her, do you have a teacher? And she said, yes. He said, I'd like to meet him. And, of course, he went and he met Ryotan. And you remember that there was the story about the candle being blown out and so on. But the point about the story is that one can be filled with all of the knowledge, all of the information, all of the sutras, indeed. And yet there is this simple question that, unless it can be answered, shows that none of it is of the least value on the spiritual path. Many people listen to this story, and particularly the part, actually, after Tokusan came to awakening when he was with Ryotan, he burned all his notes, and he was very sort of grandiose in his dismissal of philosophy and learning. And many people interpret this as being proof that one does not have to bother to read the sutras to know anything, that it's much better to be in sublime ignorance, and then the practice is that much easier. But the point about the story is not that one should not read and study and use one's mind. But the point of the story is that it itself, in itself, is not enough. In Zen, it says one must not confuse the finger that points to the moon with the moon that is being pointed at. But it does not say that one should do away with the finger. Indeed, without the finger, without the reading, without deep study and thought, without giving the matter one's full and undivided attention, which includes one's intellectual ability and analysis, unless one does this, then one will never find the way home. It is true that we have to exhaust all the resources of our being. This means that we must go to the limit of our understanding. But it does mean that we have to go to the limit of our understanding. Working in this way, thinking, studying, trying to understand, this is difficult, tedious, and arduous work very often. But the point about it is that by doing so, it breaks up one's presuppositions, one's prejudices, one's certainty that one knows already. When one studies in a transformative way, not an informative way. The sutras and anything worth reading on the spiritual path is transformative. One doesn't read the sutras or Nirsagadatta or the Bhagavad Gita or any other book that's been written by someone who knows. One doesn't read this for information. One doesn't read it in order to learn more about oneself. But on the contrary, one reads it in order to pit one's own present understanding against it. By doing this, then a creative tension is possible. And it's out of this creative tension that the transformation comes. This is one of the very difficult points that to make when we're discussing awakening. And that is that it is an intensely active process, an intensely creative process indeed. We say that you're not looking for something that is already there. There is no self that you can find. But nevertheless, the process of practice is the generation of the self. It is the creation of the self. By that we don't mean that you create something that you can then call the self and put it over there as the self. But the creative tension is the process of waking up. We often say that a person practicing Zen is an artist without an art. And unless we see it in this way, this arousal of the mind is a creative arousal. We say that the question is already the answer. But it's the questioning that is already the answer. It is already the self. But it is the questioning, it is active. It is not simply a discovery. This is one of the things that many people, we talked yesterday or the other day, about the mistake of sitting, waiting for something to happen. And people sit and wait for something to happen because they think there is something, somehow, somewhere, called the self, which, if they wait long enough, will fall into their lap. Unfortunately, in the West, we have nothing comparable to Zen Buddhism. That we did have, there were what is now called Christian mystics, which I think is a mistake. They were also people who were actively involved. God is a creation in that state. It is creativity. God is creativity, if one's going to use the word God. Just in the same way as we say the self is creativity, if we're going to use the word self. But it's best not to use either words, God or self. And nor is it a good idea to even use the word creativity. Because unfortunately the artists of today, many of them, have so abused this notion and filled it with all kinds of idiotic, arbitrary, idiosyncratic activity that it has lost what it the sharpness that it once had. But one of the things that we constantly see in the Diamond Sutra, for example, is this contradiction. It contradicts itself constantly. And it is out of that contradiction that the creative or the transformative process arises. It is that contradiction in metaphor and irony that the beauty of what is being said emerges. For example, it says, all living beings are brought to complete awakening by me. But what does that mean? Who is this me that brings all living beings to complete awakening? And then it says, yet when an infinite number of beings has been liberated, no being has been liberated. And what about that? And it says, why is this? It is because no bodhisattva, who is a real bodhisattva, cherishes the idea of an I, an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separated individuality. So who is that me that brings all living beings to awakening? And unless you see this sort of, you are alive to the contradiction, you'll miss this. It just reads, most people read it and think, oh yes, well, I don't quite understand that, but anyway, I suppose it's saying something interesting. Let's go on to the next paragraph. But it's only about that in itself is a total koan, what has just been said. The Diamond Sutra is part of the Prajnaparamita tradition. And the Prajnaparamita tradition is one of the fundamental underpinnings of koan practice. And you can read the Prajnaparamita as a koan in itself, as one continuous koan. And we've pointed out so often that you must get the twist in a koan. You must get the contradiction. The basic contradiction is no matter what you say, there is nothing is of any avail in terms of what are you. And yet you are asked, tell me, what are you? We've pointed out that the very koan itself, the what are you, is a trap. It's got a contradiction right built into that, just in the same way as what is mo. It's got a contradiction built right into that. And unless you get work within that contradiction, then you're just using the koan as a sledgehammer. And it's not a sledgehammer. It is a very intimate, subtle process. Koans are magnificent. They're extraordinary creations of humanity. And they can only be understood, like any real art, can be only be understood creatively. Understanding real art is an effort. It requires an effort. It requires that the spectator or whatever does something. It is not something one just sucks in, but one goes out to meet. And this is how it is with a koan. This is why we ask ad nauseam, do you have the question? Do you have the questioning? Because it is in that creative tension. One of the ways that this creative feeling presents itself is by a kind of hunger. There's a hunger, and that hunger comes out of the hunger for unity, for harmony, for beauty, truth, or whatever you are going to call it, and it's best you don't call it any of that. But nevertheless, there is that hunger. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. And then there's the one, has the Tathagata a teaching to enunciate? Now, the Diamond Sutra is one long teaching of Buddha. And so he says, has he a teaching? And Subhuti says, as I understand Buddha's meaning, there is no formulation of truth called consummation of incomparable enlightenment. Moreover, the Tathagata has no formulated teaching to enunciate. Now, you can sort of waffle around that. You can say, well, he means this, that, and the other. But if you take it on its face value, the Tathagata has no teaching. The Diamond Sutra is not teaching. And yet the Diamond Sutra is teaching. If it's teaching anything, it's teaching, there's no teaching. So there is a contradiction there. And this is how you must read the Diamond Sutra. This is how you must read the Prajnaparamita. It says, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no colour. And everybody chants it away quite happily. It's like the little boy that turned around and says, but I've got a nose, I've got an ear, I've got an eye. Why does the Prajnaparamita say I don't have? It's like the little boy saw the emperor didn't have any clothes on. In other words, it takes a certain innocence, a certain kind of almost stupidity to ask such a question. But obviously, it says that there was no eye, ear, nose. But if we've all got this, why does it say no? And it's exactly the same with true self is no self. One of the most obvious things is I am. All right, so why does it say no self? And again, all right, we know. What does it mean, though? And you see, it is in that, the meaning is in the aroused mind. It is not, the meaning has got no formulation. But it's only by struggling with this contradiction that you can arouse the mind in that way, such that the intrinsic light of the mind then bursts forth. And of course, it takes this is painful. I often think that a flower, when it bursts into bloom, it must go through agony. That breaking open of the bud, there must be an agonizing moment for a flower. And it is because we are unprepared, but not willing to face the pain of the bud bursting open that we never come to flower. And it is that just sitting just in the middle of it, you're not then working, you're not then going to trying to get the enlightenment, you're not trying to see into your true nature or whatever. Once you've done work to a certain extent, then the creative tension takes over. One is no longer doing anything. There is just the tension. And all that, if there's anything that one's doing, it is allowing the tension, allowing the pain, the suffering, and it is painful, allowing it to do what it needs to do. And that allowing itself is at least half of the pain. Because what we want to do is we want to close on it, and then we want to find something, and then we want to get something, and then we're off dancing down the daisy path. He says, because the Tathagata has said truth is uncontainable and inexpressible. The truth is uncontainable and inexpressible. And then it says, it neither is nor is it not. again, we've got the contradiction. Is it or isn't it? Let's come. Okay, we say, well, we understand that. That's Zen, to say it isn't, it's not. This is Zen. Zen deals with paradoxes or dilemmas or ambiguities or whatever. We can slip our way past that. We don't have to worry about that. We've taken that into account. This, after all, is a sutra, and you don't expect sense from a sutra. But what does it mean? It neither is nor is not. Mu is not something, so what is mu? Mu neither is nor is not. Now, what is it? And unless you get it, that you sit within the middle of the grip of that tension, then the rest is just wasting time. Now, the point about this is that this contradiction is not something that is being built in either by the sutra or by the koan. The tension, the contradiction, is inherent in life. Life is contradictory. And this is what Buddha said, life is suffering. Life is two, duality, dukkha. And so therefore, what the sutra is doing and what koans are doing is simply providing a vehicle by which that intrinsic suffering, intrinsic duality, intrinsic tension can arise. This is why we say it's the questioning starts with dissatisfaction. The dissatisfaction comes out of the intrinsic contradiction of existence. We don't need to go too deeply into that, but nevertheless, anybody that sits and follows the breath knows that after a while, attention arises. And then people struggle to get rid of the tension. They feel that I've somehow got to get rid of this so that I can get back to my practice, and they don't see that this tension, this dissatisfaction, this grunt feeling, is it? That's the raw material with which one works. And somehow we have to come home to that. And then it says, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no bodhicitta either. What about this? No wisdom, no awakening, if you like. No highest perfection. Again, people feel they're in despair sometimes. They feel confused and so on. They feel, well, there's something I don't understand here. It's obvious that I'm missing something. No, you're not missing a thing. Unless you see the contradiction involved in those statements, if you try to gloss it over, if you try to make sense of it, it doesn't make sense, is not supposed to make sense in the way that our logical mind conceives of sense. Of course, at another level, at a much more worthwhile level, it makes enormous sense. But it doesn't mean that when you see into this, you see into something, you get an understanding, you get an appreciation. What you get, if you struggle with no wisdom, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no bodhicitta, if one struggles with that, then what one gets is the light of the world. And it said, when told of this, he's not bewildered and in no way anxious. A bodhisattva courses in Prajnaparamita. And Prajnaparamita is wisdom and highest perfection. There's the full round there. And then there is the final verse, which is so beautiful. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world. Now, is the world fleeting for you, or is it solid as solid? And yet it is fleeting. And naturally, one is going to get, as it just said, bewildered and anxious when told of these things, when one faces this kind of contradiction. One is bewildered and one is anxious. Thus shall you think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn. What's a star at dawn? Is it there or isn't it there? If you've seen a star at dawn, you know that it appears and disappears. It not only twinkles, but the twinkle itself twinkles. It is and it isn't. A bubble in a stream. Fragile. Just the slightest touch and it's gone. And this is this world that we see around us that is so solid, which is so real, which is so hard, which is so impenetrable. A bubble in a stream. A flash of lightning in a summer cloud. Was that a flash or was it? A flickering lamp. A phantom. And a dream. So let's have a look at the sutra, the koan, sorry. One day, Tok-san went down toward the dining room, holding his bowls. Seppo, the head cook, asked, "What are you doing here with your bowls? The bell has not rung, nor has the drum been struck." Now, there is a conflict straight away. Seppo is being rude. Actually, he's being rude to the teacher, which is very wrong. But he's being rude to anyone is very wrong. In other words, there you have a contradiction between the way that one normally expects people to behave and the way Seppo is behaving. And again, if one is going to work with this, one has to, first of all, be Seppo and see what is the feeling that Seppo has as he says this. Just in the same way that when you're working on Mu, you have to be the monk, and you have to be the monk. In other words, one has to inhabit the monk. One has to see out of the monk's eyes. One has to feel the monk's feelings. And these are your feelings as you work, as you come to practice, as you come to Sesshin. And this sort of confused, irritated, embarrassed condition of Seppo when he's suddenly confronted by the teacher. And Tok-san turned and went back to his room. Now the whole point about that is what is in Tok-san's mind as he goes back to his room. You have to then be Tok-san going back to his room. You have to inhabit, you have to dwell as Tok-san going back to his room. And if you're working on this koan, you have to actually demonstrate, you have to do the walking back to the room physically. But the question is, how do you do that? What goes on? What's happening in your mind as you do that? And Seppo told Ganto all about this, and Ganto said, Toku-san is well known as a great teacher, but he doesn't know the last word of Zen. Now, what the devil's the last word of Zen? It says to know the first word is to know the last word. Now, that gets it even more confusing, even more contradictory. Is it the first or is it the last? And then it says, but neither the first nor the last is a word. And very often people say, oh, they're just koans, they make me sick, they get on your nerves. I mean, it's all a lot of nonsense. But no, there's genius in this. Because out of that struggling in that way brings to the fore your own attempt to grasp the last word of Zen, your own attempt to finally pin it down, get it under control, get to know what it is. And yet there is no such thing as the last word of Zen. So Toku-san heard of this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. And then he asked, do you not approve of my teaching? And Ganto whispered to Toku-san. Now the question there, of course, is what does Ganto whisper to Toku-san? And in that is the nub of the whole koan, and incidentally, it is the nub of the whole of the Diamond Sutra. And he says, Toku-san was silent. Again, we've got two silences. We've got the silence of Toku-san turning round and going back to his room, and we've got the silence after Ganto has whispered to him. Now, what about that? What goes on in the second silence, and how does it compare with the first silence, and can you have different kinds of silence under that circumstance? And the next day he ascended to the rostrum, and behold, his teisho was quite different from usual. And the question there, of course, is, well, what kind of teisho was that was quite different from usual? It's obviously in response to what has gone on so far. Again, in order to work with that, one must have been thoroughly involved in the drama. It's a drama in three acts. It's a whole little play that's being unfolded, and you have to be the actor. You have to be Ganto, you have to be Seppo, and you have to be Toku-san. And you have to be beyond all three, of course. His teisho was quite different from usual, and Ganto, going to the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, congratulations, our old man's got the last word. Well, what's going on here? What word has the old man got that he didn't have before? And what went on in between there to make that transformation? And all of this is to do with your own confusion. All of this is dramatizing your own uncertainty, about yourself, your own uncertainty about the practice. It's all bound up in that koan. And Mumon's commentary is very interesting. It says, as for the last word, it never entered to the mind of either Ganto or Toku-san. Why does he say that? What has that got to do with what has gone on so far? It is another form of silence that Momon is evoking there. Oh, the only way in which you can resolve this koan is through coming to awakening, to wake up, to burst into light. And then he says, when you come to look into the matter, you find they are both like puppets on the shelf. What about that? Puppets on the shelf.
Les quatre vœux.
Tous les êtres innombrables,
je fais vœu de libérer les bastions aveuglés sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir les grands voies du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir les grandes voies du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions avec les enfants, je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir les grandes voies du Bouddha. Je fais vœu